from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 1 year ago today, Colin Powell made his case to the UN that Iraq was an urgent threat. This Monday, he said the absence of weapons stockpiles, quote, changes the political calculus about whether the U.S. should have gone to war in Iraq. The next day, in a message described as, quote, coordinated with the White House, Powell said the president made the right decision. Tonight on Point, the importance of being Colin Powell and whether the U.S. Secretary of State still matters. But first, in a speech at Georgetown University this morning, CIA Director George Tenet defended pre-war U.S. intelligence on Iraq's weapons programs.
The question being asked about Iraq in the starkest terms is, were we right or were we wrong? In the intelligence business, you are almost never completely wrong or completely right. That applies in full to the question of Saddam's weapons of mass destruction. And like many of the toughest intelligence challenges, when the facts of Iraq are all in, we will neither be completely right nor completely wrong.
This speech gave Tenet an opportunity to respond to last week's Senate testimony by former Chief U.S. Weapons Inspector David Kaye, who said pre-war intelligence on weapons of mass destruction in Iraq was almost all wrong. John Diamond covers U.S. intelligence for USA Today. He joins us now from Washington. Good evening and welcome, John.
Good to be here.
John, put this speech in context for us. We've heard excerpts from it almost all day long. What exactly is George Tenet trying to do with his speech today?
It's highly unusual, maybe unprecedented, for a director of CIA to make a statement of this kind outside the context of a congressional hearing, focused almost entirely on one intelligence issue, in this case Iraq, and also focused on defending the agency against criticism. So this was a rare event. The CIA director makes really only about one major public appearance a year. That's an appearance before Congress, the annual threat assessment, they call it. He might give a couple of commencement addresses, and that's about it. So it's important to understand how unusual this is. His agency is under attack. U.S. intelligence is under attack for getting the estimate of Iraq wrong. And he's trying to position himself and his agency, protect its reputation.
Let me ask you, John, is he lining up with the Bush White House line, or is he lining up against David Kaye? Who's he defending himself from here?
Mainly this was a rebuttal to David Kaye. David Kaye said last week, we were all wrong. You just played the soundbite of Tenet saying that you're almost never always right or wrong. Tenet, of course, it's true what he's saying, but it's a bit disingenuous because it's rare that U.S. intelligence, at least at this point, has ever been found to be this spectacularly wrong about a major intelligence estimate that was an integral part of a decision to go to war. That is that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction, and now none of them have been found nearly a year later. He leaves open the possibility that they may be found. He says more work needs to be done, that all the answers aren't in. The one place where he might have said something uncomfortable to the Bush administration was he made a point of saying that we in U.S. intelligence never said the threat was imminent. This, in a sense, leaves the Bush administration and the White House hanging out to dry because he's saying that the intelligence community never said it was an emergency.
John, let us listen to that bit. We've got it right here.
Analysts differed on several important aspects of these programs, and those debates were spelled out in the estimate. They never said there was an imminent threat. Rather, they painted an objective assessment for our policymakers of a brutal dictator who is continuing his efforts to deceive and build programs that might constantly surprise us and threaten our interests.
CIA Director George Tenet at Georgetown University today never said there was an imminent threat. As you say, John Diamond, that leaves the Bush administration on its own hook a bit.
It does. The Bush administration now must take responsibility for the many statements that it made that strongly indicated that there was great urgency to this whole venture. The word imminent does not show up very often at all in any of the administration statements. I think the dogged searchers have found Scott McClellan using it once. But there are phrases like no terrorist state poses a greater or more immediate threat, by Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld. A threat of unique urgency. That's a statement by President Bush.
Mm-hmm.
The phrase urgent threat by Bush, real and present danger by Secretary Colin Powell. So it was clear that the administration was saying there's a present danger that needs to be dealt with. Now, U.S. intelligence cannot completely get off the hook on this, however, because there is now in the public domain a portion of the national intelligence estimate that the CIA put out in October of 2002, the period when the big decisions were being made. And the first page of that document says that that Iraq could get a nuclear weapon under certain circumstances within several months.
Mm-hmm.
The opening pages talk about the possibility of using unmanned aerial vehicles in attacks on the United States. Senator Nelson of Florida made the statement last week during the David Kay hearing that he got closed briefings. He and other senators were given closed briefings by the CIA talking about the possibility that chemical or biological weapons could be used on U.S. targets.
So there was a lot of CIA work that was out there that was picked up. But George Bush has been very supportive of George Tenet. Can he abide by George Tenet saying, we never said there was an imminent threat? Does this cut something between the president and his CIA director or not?
Well, at this point, there is, of course, a definite tension between the White House and the CIA. However, there seems to be a notable lack of tension personally between Bush and Tenet. Tenet is a survivor. He has managed to ingratiate himself with the president. They get along. They're similar in age. They're both sports fans. Tenet sees the president 6 days a week, most weeks. They have a rapport. And the president has repeatedly said he has confidence in his CIA director and confidence in intelligence.
The trouble
with firing Tenet at this point would be that it would be a major public admission of a problem at a time when the White House is loath to do that.
And yet Tenet's organization may be under attack by this commission the president's putting together. We're running short on time here,
right,
John, but this is a dance we're going to have to follow and follow closely. And thank you so much for bringing us your insight tonight.
You're very welcome.
John Diamond covers U.S. intelligence for USA Today. He spoke with me from Washington. One year ago today, Colin Powell made a landmark speech in front of the UN Security Council warning of a serious, urgent, and material threat from Iraqi weapons of mass destruction. It was, in effect, the American case for war, and Powell delivered it with the full force of his considerable standing.
My colleagues, every statement I make today is backed up by sources, solid sources. These are not assertions. What we're giving you are facts and conclusions based on solid intelligence.
He went on to share some of this intelligence.
Our conservative estimate is that Iraq today has a stockpile of between 100 and 500 tons of chemical weapons agent. That is enough agent to fill 16,000 battlefield rockets. Even the low end of 100 tons of agent would enable Saddam Hussein to cause mass casualties across more than 100 square miles of territory, an area nearly five times the size of Manhattan.
Saddam Hussein's weapons, he argued, posed a serious and urgent threat.
The facts and Iraq's behavior demonstrate that Saddam Hussein and his regime have made no effort to disarm as required by the international community. Indeed, the facts and Iraq's behavior show that Saddam Hussein and his regime are concealing their efforts to produce more weapons of mass destruction.
When Colin Powell made that case for war a year ago, the nation and the world listened. He had credibility and stature. Today, his standing and role as Secretary of State appear to be shrunken. Tonight on Point, the Colin Powell story. Does this man still matter? And what do you see today in the Secretary of State? Has Colin Powell fought the good fight? Is he an empty suit? Is he an American hope or American history? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Ivo Dalder, Senior Fellow of Foreign Policy Studies at the Brookings Institution and former Director of European Affairs at the National Security Council. His new book is America Unbound, The Bush Revolution in Foreign Policy. Good evening and welcome, Ivo Dalder.
Good
Glad to be here.
Also joining me from Washington is David Korn, Washington editor of The Nation magazine and author of The Lies of George W. Bush, Mastering the Politics of Deception. Good evening and welcome, David Korn.
Good to be with you.
Great to have you. And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guests.
So, someday and some week for Colin Powell, David Korn, the world was absolutely rapt watching the Secretary of State a year ago as he, and we just heard it, as he laid down the case point by point by point. He told us he had been to the CIA, he had sat at the desk there and gone over everything he was presenting to us. He mustered really all of his very substantial credibility built up over so many years to make the case that these weapons of mass destruction were there and the danger was urgent. How do you see the Secretary of State standing today? How effective is he? How's his reputation?
Well, I think it should be rather tarnished. And I'm sorry to say that because I do think he was the one figure in the Bush administration who did have a reputation, a positive reputation abroad, which I think is important for us to have, at least in part. But in the clip that you just played a moment ago,
yeah,
he said that everything is backed up by sources, everything that he said. Well, we could go through a chapter and verse, but two quick points. In that presentation a year ago, he claimed that there was a sinister nexus between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein. That was part of the Bush case for war, not just that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, but that on any given day, as Bush said, on any given day, he could hand them to al-Qaeda because there was an operational alliance between the two. Colin Powell called it a sinister nexus.
Mm-hmm.
Well, just about 2 weeks ago, asked about a report put out by the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, which challenged the evidence for that connection, Colin Powell said that he had seen no smoking gun or concrete evidence of such a connection. It was a possibility and a, quote, prudent concern at the time. That's a lot different than saying there's a nexus backed up by sources. And when the clip you just played in which he said our conservative estimate, I emphasize conservative estimate, is that Saddam Hussein had 100 to 50 to 500 tons of chemical weapons agent. I just went back and looked at the National Intelligence Estimate today, which you can get online. Anyone can check me on this. And they said that they thought that there was probably 100, possibly 500, but also the Defense Intelligence Agency said that they had no reliable information on whether Saddam Hussein had stockpiles. So for him to say that our conservative estimate is 100 to 500 tons, again, it was contradicted by the own intelligence they had at the time.
That they had themselves.
He was involved in a spin campaign.
Ivo Dalder, help us look at this. Colin Powell this week came out after David Kaye's comments and said he didn't know about those weapons of mass destruction, that maybe the political calculus was changed. He's called into the White House, and the next day his line is again supportive of the president. Where does Colin Powell's reputation stand today after this year, the damning comparison, at least on the surface, between what we see now and what we heard a year ago?
Well, of course, Colin Powell's reputation is in some sense affected. A year ago today, he made a number of statements, in fact, 29 specific allegations, not one of which has proven so far to be true.
So that's just a little dent in a reputation? It sounds...
Except that it depends on who the messenger is and in what administration he's carrying the message and on what basis he's doing it. A number of mitigating factors. One, he did go over to the CIA. He looked at all the data. He sifted through it. He threw out at least 50% of the script that the vice president's office had provided to him. 75% of all the allegations.
Does that matter if the remaining 90% was so wrong?
Well, but I think what the question is, was Colin Powell wrong or was there a larger problem here?
Mm-hmm.
The larger problem is the one we just talked about a little earlier, which is that the intelligence that we had, the very estimate that was being produced in itself turned out to be wrong. One of the interesting things about the speech that you were talking with John Diamond about by George Tenet just a little while ago is that George Tenet, when he says what his bottom line is today with regard to these capabilities, it is that there was an intent to produce chemical weapons by Saddam, an intent to produce biological.
Ivo Dalder, hold it there. We've got to take a short break. David Korn, Jack Beatty, will be right back. We're talking about the importance of being Colin Powell. What is that importance? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the incredible shrinking Colin Powell. It was 1 year ago today that he made his big speech before the United Nations, laying out the American case for war, the American case that there were volumes of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Now David Kaye says, wrong, almost all wrong. You can join our conversation tonight. Has Colin Powell fought the good fight, or is he an empty suit? What's the Powell imprint on the Bush administration's foreign policy? Can you find one? Is this man a leader, a loyalist, a lackey? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight by Ivo Dalder, Senior Fellow in Foreign Policy Studies at the Brookings Institution, David Korn, Washington editor of The Nation magazine, and our own Jack Beatty. Let's listen to just a little bit more of Colin Powell's testimony 1 year ago today before the world.
There can be no doubt that Saddam Hussein has biological weapons and the capability to rapidly produce more, many more. And he has the ability to dispense these lethal poisons and diseases in ways that can cause massive death and destruction.
There he is, Colin Powell, 1 year ago. The world looks quite different today. Jack Beatty, it's almost a Greek tragedy of some kind here, but how do you interpret this saga of Colin Powell over the last year, over all of his time in the Bush administration as Secretary of State?
Well, you know, perhaps it's romantic of me, but this man might have stopped the drift to war. He had precedents to do that. William Jennings Bryan resigned in principle over President Wilson's harsh note on the Lusitania, and he made a point of saying, Mr. President, you're disguising the fact that this ship was carrying munitions to Britain. Cyrus Vance resigned after Jimmy Carter's abortive attempt to rescue the hostages in Iran went awry. That was one model. He also had a model right in his own administration, in Paul O'Neill, who was clearly making his views known about the president's, in his eyes, reckless economic policies. And here's what he writes in his book, or in the book about him. He says, real loyalty is based on inquiry and telling someone what you really think and feel, your best estimation of the truth instead of what they want to hear. You know, so you apply a man within his administration who seemed to honor it. He was fired, but he was clearly objecting to policy. You look at past precedents of secretaries of state who resigned on principle, and you see this man had two choices. He could have gone in that direction. Instead, he went for the Robert McNamara model, the loyal soldier, serving a policy he really didn't believe in. And, you know, and essentially losing his credibility not only for sober judgment, but for the sort of moral authority that people invested in him. And certainly the, you know, President Bush made no more important decision politically in the campaign of 2000 than to say Colin Powell will be my Secretary of State. All over America, people went, whew, that's great. This thing is going to work fine with that man in there. He betrayed, in a way, he betrayed himself worse. I think he betrayed his oath of office, which is not to be loyal to a family, but to be loyal to the country.
That's an indictment, David Korn. Should this Secretary of State resign, or is he still important to carrying a certain vantage on world affairs in the Bush administration?
Well, I don't feel we're in any position to ask him to resign in particular. You may as well ask Dick Cheney to resign for saying that the tractor trailers were biological weapons labs after the CIA said that there was no conclusive proof. Mm. You could ask George Bush to resign for saying there were massive stockpiles of biological weapons there when the CIA hadn't said that in its own intelligence. Donald Rumsfeld, Paul Wolfowitz. I mean, I don't hold Colin Powell any more responsible than these other folks. And I do agree with Jack. I think there's a certain tragedy here. I wasn't a big Colin Powell fan before this. I've looked at his career, and I see him as playing the good soldier time and time again. He did so during Iran-Contra and in other episodes we don't have to rehearse here. So it's not a surprise to me that at the end of the day, he's playing the good soldier once again. But I do think it's a pity that he wasn't able to use the standing that he had for good or wrong reasons to stop a drift for war, and that he got suckered into this propaganda campaign and became the front person. And I would hope, you know, just on a personal level, that he's angry about that.
Ivo Dalder, how about it? Same question to you. I mean, Jack raised the notion of resignation here. When things went the way they did, should Colin Powell have resigned? And he's still there. Is he effective there?
Well, those are there's sort of three questions here. I mean, first, I think underlying Jack Beatty's argument is the notion that Colin Powell disagreed with the policy. There is no evidence for that, certainly not after September 11th, that this Secretary of State disagreed fundamentally with the president on the question of whether or not we should go to war.
And yet, you know, it is conventional wisdom. And Maureen Dowd, writing the New York Times today, says Colin Powell should start interfering where he does belong. The secretary should get off the sidelines where the vice president and Pentagon banished him and stop waiting for them to fail so he can be vindicated. He should get more involved in rescuing Iraq from chaos. That suggests there was a different point of view here. You say no.
No, I think there were differences of nuance and differences of style and differences really of what we were trying to do. I think Colin Powell tried very hard and in some sense partially succeeded in moving the president to making this an issue not about the regime change per se, but about the enforcement of UN Security Council resolutions.
So does that put the WMT fallacies at Colin Powell's doorstep? Would George Bush simply have said, this is a bad guy, we have to take him out?
No, George Bush bought into the WMD issue at least as a means towards the end that he was seeking. Colin Powell bought into the WMD issue in order to justify going to the United Nations, which he did, in order to get a UN Security Council resolution, which he did, unanimously, I would argue. There is no debate anywhere about the fact that Saddam Hussein was in full and complete violation of that Security Council resolution. None. Kay has said it. Tennant has said it. There is absolutely no basis to make any argument that he wasn't.
Right, but the import of that fact was given heft by the assertion that there were all kinds of weapons of mass destruction behind that disobedience.
And so we are faced with a fundamental intelligence failure that needs to be examined. I think Colin Powell was as much a victim of that failure as the American people and the rest of us.
Can I like to differ with Evo?
David Korn, please.
I mean, I'm a big Evo daughter fan, so I mean, it's not personal here. I think there's a problem though with saying it was just an intelligence failure.
No, with regard to Colin Powell, I fully agree with what you said with regard to Rumsfeld,
if Colin Powell goes to the CIA and sits down and they tell him all this stuff, and he goes, which the Bush administration still accepted, you know, above and beyond the call of duty, and still, you know, they're still clinging to some of those assertions. Mm. At what point does he say this is a corrupt enterprise? I don't want to participate in this any longer. I mean, Bush went out there and said Al Qaeda. Saddam Hussein is dealing with al-Qaeda, that they're allies. You know, Colin Powell told us 2 weeks ago that he doesn't believe that. He didn't believe, you know, I don't know what he believed when he gave the speech a year ago, but now he says there's no evidence. So at what point does he look at what's happening around him and the abuse of intelligence as well as the partial failures of intelligence and say, you know, I'm out of here. I can't be here. You know, I can't do honest business with this gang.
Evil Dalder?
Yeah.
You know, yes, and everybody will have to make those decisions for himself. And Colin Powell, as I think both of you have said, has a record of making decisions where he is the soldier that salutes. But I do think that this is a man who there's a problem in this administration. The problem is at the top. It's with the president and the vice president who have misled the country deliberately. They have taken information and gone well beyond that information. I don't think Colin Powell is the main problem in this issue.
Well, the main problem that seems to put a lot of weight on him.
At what point does he, you know, empower them?
Yeah, and you know, well, you know, the day he gave that speech, to Evo's point about, you know, he accepted what the CIA said. The day he gave that speech on this program, we juxtaposed his remarks with things the weapons inspectors had said about the sites that he mentioned.
Yep.
We went through four or five of these right in a row. Here's what Powell said. Here's what the weapons inspectors and the press said about these same sites. And it was night and day. His assertion about the unmanned drones. Well, we practically laughed at that. And a few weeks later, John Burns actually found one. And the thing had a Briggs & Stratton lawnmower engine on it. Mm. The point is, there was information available then to not only make him skeptical, but scornful of this kind of information. Instead, it was almost as if he had a, I'm going to armor myself in the, you know, he didn't want to know that. Just no one in that administration seemed to want to know that.
I think this is why we're going to have, and we're having an investigation in the Senate and in the House, and we're going to have an independent commission. Because there are lots of pieces of data that you and I don't know about, and that he does. And take the UAVs.
But he put a lot of those on display in public a year ago, Evil Dalder, and practically every point he laid out there has since been disproved. Isn't that enough?
Yes, of course he was wrong. I'm not disputing he was wrong.
But aren't we also counting on a man of his stature? If you're saying there's a problem at the top with the president and vice president, aren't we counting on a man of Colin Powell's experience and stature and position to intervene? Isn't that his job?
Let me make a fundamental distinction here. When Colin Powell went in front of the UN and the world and the country, I have no doubt that he believed at the moment that what he was saying was exactly based on the facts as he had found them. That, in fact, all the statements that we have just gone through were in the National Intelligence Estimate that we now have declassified.
But isn't there a lapse of judgment here? I mean, because now we're saying, yes, there were all kinds of bits of intelligence, but it was all in how they were played, spun, presented. Doesn't it make him party to that?
Well, Colin Powell, for example, never said that there was an active reconstitution of the nuclear weapons program, a major difference between what he said and what was being said by the president. That was notable. He had to make a decision. He believed, I know he believed, that there were large stockpiles of chemical and biological weapons. Mm. Frankly, everybody believed it. People who worked in the Clinton administration believed it. People who worked on the Congress, who voted for the resolution, believed it. And the problem is that it wasn't true. As David Kaye said, we were all wrong.
That is the
problem. You can't blame this all on one man.
We hear you. Evil Dalder, David Korn, Jack Standby. I want to welcome to our conversation from Princeton, New Jersey, Brady Keesling. He's a visiting lecturer at the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs. Brady Keesling resigned last February after 20 years as a career diplomat in embassies from Tel Aviv to Athens in protest of, quote, our fervent pursuit of war with Iraq. Good evening and welcome, Brady Keesling.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for being with us on this anniversary day of Colin Powell's big speech before the UN. He was your boss. How do you see him now? Is this a man who's done the right thing as best he understood it, or something less?
I still have tremendous respect for him, I have to say. The one point that hasn't been made is this. President Bush has been absolutely catastrophic in terms of America's ability to project its interests around the world. The face and voice of America that he's projected has really hurt us around the world. Colin Powell has been the guy who's come in and, because of this incredible personality and respect he commands, has been able to reduce that damage to the point where we can almost afford to have a president who is as weak and ineffective in foreign policy terms.
So you believe he's genuinely protected it that well?
I believe things would be much worse without him. Let's put it this way. I think under a better president, Colin Powell would be one of the best secretaries of state we've ever had, despite being very conservative, far more conservative than I am. Still, he is a really good diplomat. He's a very good manager. I have a lot of respect for him. I don't believe his resignation would have helped, would have deterred the war.
So you resigned, but he shouldn't have.
I resigned because it seemed a cheap sacrifice, and it had a useful role at the time. I can understand perfectly well why he didn't.
Colin Powell, you must be in touch with people in the State Department, does he still have a strong reputation as a leader there, or does it look like he's been rolled, sidelined, in Maureen Dowd's words?
I think the general consensus is the whole State Department has been sidelined. The problem is, the best lack all conviction and the worst are full of passionate intensity. You know, a bunch of people wearing very thick ideological blinders are in charge of things. The State Department, which basically thrives on nuance and ambiguity and uncertainty, gets rolled every time unless you have a president with the political sense and the courage to stand up for it. We have a president who doesn't know the world, doesn't know the State Department, and has left us hanging out to dry.
We have a lot of callers who want to join this conversation. I want to invite them in. Ven is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Ven. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a comment to make and a question to your guest. The first comment is I'd like to tie up the story you're talking about right now and the story of today by statement by Mr. Tenet.
Yes.
Mr. Tenet kept saying that in intelligence there's nothing totally right and nothing totally wrong.
Yep.
However, Mr. Powell last year in his speech made that, used words like solid sources, facts.
It was all right, in other words, in his presentation.
Yes, it was like, that means he mentioned it in such a way that
yep.
it was everything which was correct and 100% true.
Yep.
I have a lot of respect for Mr. Powell. However, my question is, will he be able to emerge from this crisis which he's going through in his credibility if he alienates himself with the Bush and if he still has time? The inquiries coming out and stuff.
Ven, we've got it. Our time's running down before the break. Evo Dollar, let me put that question to you. Colin Powell sidelined, and if so, can he still reemerge? Can he be a potent player in the Bush administration? If the Bush administration shall be a one-term administration, how does Colin Powell come out looking?
Well, Colin Powell has been sidelined from day one. The consensus within this administration is far, far to the right from where Colin Powell is. And Powell's basic role in this administration has been to try to chip away on the heartline extremism of the vice president and the secretary of defense, and frankly, of the president himself. And sometimes he can effect that on the margin. But let's not kid ourselves. Colin Powell has not been very influential about American foreign policy since the day he became secretary of state. So he doesn't have very far to go if his credibility is impacted in that sense. But he believes that chiseling away at the issue by issue, makes things less bad than it otherwise would be, just as Brady Kiesling mentioned a little while ago.
Brady, I know we just got you for another minute. Could someone else have done a better job? Might someone else do a better job there even now if they were closer to the president's perspective, the vice president's, therefore more influential?
It depends. I think that with the Cheney-Rumsfeld view of the world, so profoundly pessimistic, it's impossible for the U.S. administration to communicate effectively with our key allies. I think that someone who could deliver, who could make promises and deliver on them, it would be nice to have, but the only way he could do that is by making promises no one else in the world is interested in. And Powell did his best, could not move the administration very far, but at least he's respected in Europe for having tried.
We've got to take a break. Brady Kiesling, thank you for joining us tonight.
You're very welcome.
Brady Kiesling resigned last February after 20 years as a career diplomat in protest of the war with Iraq. We're talking tonight about the importance of being Colin Powell, perhaps the incredible shrinking Colin Powell. You can join our conversation. David Korn is with us, Evo Dalder, Jack Beatty. Do you remember Colin Powell's testimony a year ago today at the UN? Did he move you? Did he persuade you? Is Colin Powell today Washington's voice of reason, or is he irrelevant? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. It was 1 year ago today that Colin Powell made his epic case for war at the United Nations. We're asking tonight if Colin Powell still matters. We're joined tonight by Evo Dalder, senior fellow in foreign policy studies at the Brookings Institution. His new book is America Unbound, The Bush Revolution in Foreign Policy, by David Korn, Washington editor of The Nation magazine. His book is The Lies of George W. Bush, Mastering the Politics of Deception. Our own Jack Beatty is with us as well, and you can join us. What's the use of being Colin Powell now in this Washington? What's your advice for the Secretary of State, and what's the lesson of the Colin Powell story? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. One year ago today, Colin Powell was beating the UN about the ears and telling them to listen to the solid evidence he had to report, else they risked irrelevance.
This body places itself in danger of irrelevance if it allows Iraq to continue to defy its will without responding effectively and immediately. The issue before us is not how much time we are willing to give the inspectors to be frustrated by Iraqi obstruction. But how much longer are we willing to put up with Iraq's noncompliance before we, as a council, we as the United Nations say, enough, enough? The gravity of this moment is matched by the gravity of the threat that Iraq's weapons of mass destruction pose to the world.
Colin Powell, 1 year ago today. Evil Dollar, when you listen to that now, what goes through your mind?
Well, the world's changed, I think, as Colin Powell told the Washington Post on Monday. The political calculus at the time would have been different if we knew then what we know now.
And he took it back on Tuesday.
Well, he did take it back because he does work for the White House, and at some point he has to decide. At some point he resigns or he goes on. This is a man who tends to go on. We may all want it differently, but I would go back to what's the alternative if he does resign? Do we want to have Paul Wolfowitz as our Secretary of State? And what would that do for our standing in the world? I agree again with Brad Kiesling, who said that for all the little that Colin Powell has done, the one thing he has done is that there's at least some people in the world still have a little bit of faith in us as long as he's in power.
David Korn, do you agree? We're better off with him in there than the potential alternatives.
Well, you know, the thing here though is it's pretty commonly accepted. I don't know how these things become commonly accepted that Colin Powell will not be sticking around much into the second term, if there is a second term. So the notion that America is gaining a slight bit by its image overseas by having him there, rather than showing the world what truly the true face of foreign policy here, I don't think that's a wonderful trade-off here, especially if Colin Powell helps George W. Bush and this foreign policy that Evo and others disagree with get reelected. I mean, there comes a point where you can look at Colin Powell and say, he's a beard. He's an effective beard. He's having some, you know, minimum positive influence, but he's also making the Bush administration perhaps look marginally better or marginally less worse than it deserves to. And that goes to the same goes true with the way it appears to the American public, which is going to be a big issue when it comes to the election next November. So I think by sticking around, particularly if he's not going to stick around for the next 4 years, he's actually doing the world community and the national community a disservice by implying that he is part of the team and will be part of the team that's going to be here for the next 4 years. And at the end of the day, I think the public should really see if Paul Wolfowitz and Donald Rumsfeld are the ones truly calling the shots on foreign policy. Let people know that.
It still does look thinly like the implication. Listeners, what do you think? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Joe's calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
Hi. I just think it's ridiculous to suggest so cavalierly that Colin Powell should resign or anything like that. If you, sir, were charged with making the decisions for the security of this country that he is, you might think twice about making your decisions so quickly.
You don't want to walk away from your post. I grant you that. But, Joe, what should a Secretary of State do when, if indeed this is the case, the White House is carrying out a policy that is in opposition to his own best instincts?
I'm not sure if it was in opposition to his own best instincts. That is to say, I believe he acted upon the best intelligence given him, and that there's a lot. We're a better country now, and this is a safer world now as the result of us going to war with Iraq.
So never mind if the testimony before the UN was wrong, that the gist came out right in your mind.
Never mind that we were wrong on the weapons of mass destruction. We acted on the best intelligence that we had. Robert McNamara said that, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, the best intelligence they had was that there were no functioning missiles yet down in Cuba.
Right.
They were ready to go in.
Right.
As it turns out, there were 90 functioning missiles.
Yes, there were.
Do not suggest that it's so cavalierly that people charged with making these types of decisions, should resign if they're wrong.
Joe, stick with us, Joe.
What happened here was the White House didn't say that we don't know, there's worries, there are concerns, we can't risk it. They said there was no doubt. They said they knew for sure. They said the intelligence was rock solid. All those things are not true. Rather than level with the American public and say, we don't want to take the risk, look at what happened in Cuba 40 years ago, they made the case that they knew when even George Tenet today told us on many of the key fronts, they did not know. That's what's wrong here.
We've lost Joe, but Jack Beatty, what do you make of his case? Let's not be cavalier. A man is tasked to a duty here, and perhaps he thought it was indeed the right thing. And he also looks back at the Robert McNamara story and says, look, McNamara, they didn't know in the Cuban Missile Crisis. It came out. It worked their way. How does all that resonate with you, Jack?
Well, I mean, I understand what he's saying, and I think the president is pretty much saying the same thing. Look, it's settled. This man was a tyrant. We got rid of him, and that's that. Let's not quibble about how we got in there. But as I suggested earlier, there is some evidence, contrary to what Ivo is saying. I know he probably knows better than I do, but at least I've seen some evidence that Powell did not agree with this policy. For example, right after September 11th, when Bush made the speech, about, even before Bush made the speech, people talked about, you know, we're going to have regime change in states that are harboring terrorists, and Iraq is one of them. He came right out and said, no, this is about al-Qaeda, mm-hmm. stateless terrorism, so on. Then, you know, he'd already worked out a new sanctions policy that was supposed to get us off the moral hook for our sanctions. And then, even as late as the countdown to war, his State Department came out with what I think is still a very cogent paper saying no falling dominoes, no democracy dominoes, casting doubt on the whole sort of, you know, okay, so there aren't any weapons of mass destruction, but we can create a democracy there, and won't that be great? Putting all sorts of historical and, you know, basically scorning that argument. Now, he approved that. So I don't know. This makes me think that, you know, there are two possibilities here, and one is discreditable to him, and that is that after the French ambassador to the UN stiffed him, he called it sandbagged him, in October and made, and, you know, turned what was, you know, essentially betrayed him and made him look bad publicly to people in the administration, that he really just went into, I want to know only what I need to know to make this thing work. He just, personal pique entered into it. The creditable hypothesis is that this is about career with this man. This is about, and that this crowd would have taken us into war if he hadn't made a kind of implicit trade-off with Bush. We're not going to do Korea. We know that his deputy made a statement to the senators. We are going to negotiate with North Korea, and Bush put him against the wall for that. But the fact is, we are going to negotiate with North Korea, and it may be, Powell's biographers will have to say, that we owe that to Colin Powell.
Ewald Elder, how about it? Joe in Milwaukee says, look, maybe Colin Powell agreed with this all the way along, and that he did the right thing. On the other hand, maybe he didn't agree, and maybe he's been pushed up against the wall again and again here. First, how do you see that? And second, if this Secretary of State shouldn't resign, in what circumstances should a Secretary of State resign over differences, if you think there are, with the White House?
My sort of view of Colin Powell is he believed prior to 9/11 that going to war against Iraq was nuts. He, in fact, wasn't particularly in favor of going to war back in 1991. After 9/11, like most Americans whose changes and calculations of risk changed, Colin Powell's changed.
But Jack cites his brushing off the regime change line after 9/11.
Yeah, immediately after, he said Afghanistan had to be first and had to be most importantly, and going after al-Qaeda. By January of 2002, he's testifying on the Hill that Saddam Hussein is a major threat to the United States. That this is after the Axis of Evil speech. That unlike the question with North Korea and Iran, force will have to be on the table with regard to Iraq.
And you believe that's Colin Powell talking, Colin Powell a puppet?
I believe by 2002, Colin Powell is convinced on the chemical and the biological, not on the nuclear side. I don't think he was ever convinced on the nuclear side, that there were large stockpiles of chemical and biological weapons, that we should provide them, Iraq, with one more chance to come clean, that chance was indeed granted through the United Nations in the resolution passed in November 2002, that I think in part because he was sandbagged by the French, he gave up on the effort of trying to do this through the United Nations, and decided that war was the least bad of all the alternatives. That is why the fact that he's now been confronted with the absence of stockpiles, he, in the moment of candor, in the Washington Post, said that would change the political calculus. And I think so. I don't think he should resign over something that he didn't disagree with. He agreed with going to war. He agreed when it happened. He even agreed to some extent how it happened, though only to some extent. He's now confronted, like many who favored the wars, and indeed many who didn't favor the war, with a piece of evidence that nobody expected. Everybody that I know of expected to have large stockpiles of chemical and biological weapons being found in Iraq. They haven't been found. They're not there. And that is one of our major problems.
So you're granting Colin Powell that he legitimately, truly, honestly thought this was the way to go, that he wasn't just standing up and being the good soldier. I don't know. Michael's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I am one of those who was opposed to the war but watched Colin Powell's speech before the United Nations. And because of my faith in his integrity and because he made such a convincing presentation, I was almost convinced. I mean, he showed those trailers and then they were gone, and he talked about the uranium coming in from Africa, and he talked about the tubes.
It was powerful.
And it was very powerful, and he almost convinced me. And I feel betrayed. He had such a fine reputation as a leader and as a man of integrity and a caring man that I wanted to believe him, even if I didn't believe Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz.
Michael, let me ask you this in that case. Does it matter to you whether Colin Powell actually believed what he was delivering? In other words, he misjudged along with everyone else. Or, on the other hand, if he didn't fully believe it, but it was the administration line, does either of those ameliorate? Is one of those alternatives better than the other?
Not really, because he's had plenty of time to resign since, and that's my main point for the call. Let's say that he didn't believe it, but he was just being a loyal trooper. Okay, so there's no integrity there. He's just one more a member of the Bush Rove, Cheney Inc.
Administration
government. Mm-hmm. But let's say he did believe it, which is, I guess, what I believe. He should, since when all the evidence came out, have resigned and said, I was duped, I was used, I was misled.
Well, then in that case, what about David Corn's point? If he should resign, then, you know, what about Dick Cheney and the president and everybody else?
Well, I don't have any faith in them as people of integrity. I'm saying is assuming that the Secretary of State, Colin Powell, is or was a man of the integrity that many of us thought he was. Part of the problem, you see, is that in this country we do not have a tradition of cabinet secretaries resigning on fundamental differences from a president.
We basically do not. Michael, our time is short at that. I've got to cut it. But, Evil Doll, let me put it to you. Do you see Colin Powell on his way out with the sun setting on this first term or this term of George Bush? Is there any scenario under which he might stay on?
No, I don't think so. I think he's made it very clear that he wants to go back and tinker with his Volvos at the end of the term. And the real issue is he going to resign before the end of the term or not?
What's your instinct?
My instinct is he's not. That's not the kind of person he is, in part because of what Michael said. This is not a country where there is a lot of this is not Britain, where people resign over policy difference or, indeed, when their integrity has been challenged in the way that I think Michael has rightly done just now.
David Corn, just a few seconds left. What's the epitaph for Colin Powell's time as Secretary of State in that case?
I was abused, and I went along with it. And therefore, I gave aid and comfort to my abusers, and I helped them to get reelected.
Yeah, with that, we are out of time. David Corn, Washington editor of The Nation magazine, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Ivo Dalder, senior fellow in foreign policy studies at the Brookings Institution, thank you very much for being with us. Great to have you.
My pleasure.
And Jack, last word goes to you.
Well, I share the feeling of our caller from Cambridge that I did expect more from him than I do from these other people because of what I thought, what I still think is a man of some decency and integrity.
It's a hard thing to watch. It will all play out. Jack, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.